From the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette, this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us for today's program. If ever you've got a question for us, send that via email to news@wbaa.org, or you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. I see you've come in your Purdue sweater vest today. It must be nice to finally have it not be winter around here anymore.
Isn't it? And, yeah, we were doing a little video for the upcoming Day of Giving, so I had a special request to wear something with a logo front and center. But, no, I think we're all glad that spring is here and campus is looking beautiful again.
I wanted to start today's program with a couple of comments from Senator Luke Kenly, and he made some interesting thoughts on how he's looking at the Senate's budget proposal this year. And one of the things that struck out to me that I really wanted to mention to you was he says he's including a little more money in this year's Senate budget to try to forestall tuition increases at the public universities. And this, of course, is something you've been working on here. Were you surprised to hear him say this at all?
No, because Luke Kenly has been a champion of higher education for a long time, but he's for many years pressed the universities to be more careful with the tuition hikes. So these are longtime themes of his. He's been one reason that Indiana, the national study of this showed that Indiana is third in the nation among the states in maintaining higher ed spending through the recent downturn and the weak economy we still have. And, some Hoosiers and the Boilermakers don't know this, but, I just came back from a trip in Arizona. They've had 30 or 35% cuts there. We all hear about California. Senator Kenly is one reason that Indiana has leaned against that national trend better than almost any other state. But he has been a little bit of a scold about tuition increases for many years. You know, when we went 2 years ago and announced our first freeze since extended, I made it plain that this was not conditional on more state aid. We'll only do this if you give us more money. We said we think that more support is justified. Hope you'll choose to do so, but that Purdue was going to try to take a step for affordability. I know for a fact that was well met and appreciated. And so to hear him return to this theme is not surprising to me, and I hope other schools will take him seriously.
You called him something of a scold, and I think that's a fair statement. A few years ago, when we were in the middle of the economic downturn, he threatened to withhold $40 or $50 million of funding to IU and Purdue if they didn't kind of get in line with what he thought was appropriate in terms of tuition increases. So this is a slightly different tack, it seems to me, where you mentioned that you said you were not instituting the tuition or freeze if you got more money, but now you're actually potentially going to get more money, at least in the Senate's version of the bill. So is the senator taking a somewhat of a different tack? Because I think there were some people a couple of years ago who thought it was sort of an unfunded mandate, and now here's some extra dollars that are appended, at least in the Senate's version of the budget.
Oh, the General Assembly did well by higher education the last time around. Some of it was taken back or tentatively taken back by executive action. But the last budget turned out to be a pretty good one, even though other schools were still raising tuition as they had been. I started by saying that Senator Kenly and has been among the champions of higher ed. He was an ally of mine in trying to support higher education, but he's also been consistent in saying, "Hey, let's be careful about the burden on students and their families." So neither of those themes is new.
Senator Kenly had also talked about taking a closer look at both Ivy Tech and at the IPFW campus in Fort Wayne. And the interesting thing he said about Fort Wayne was, he says, "Look, Northeast Indiana is growing, and we're not sure that the IPFW campus is kind of keeping up with the growth we see elsewhere in the northeast part of the state." And so he wants to examine that relationship a little bit more closely. What did you make of that comment?
I think we all are looking hard at IPFW and seeing how it could be an even greater asset to its region. And as you know, we've taken an initiative that's been very well received over there to suggest to the Commission on Higher Education they redesignated a metropolitan university with concomitant changes that would, we think, reflect its importance and potential importance to what, he's correct, has been a reasonably vital area of the state economically.
So what might you do to aid that that analysis of where IPFW fits into that larger sector of the state?
I hope we've done it by advocating this new idea. And again, it's been well received. We'll continue to do so. As I understand it, is likely to be on the agenda of the Higher Ed Commission later this year.
Any way that that campus would have to change the way it does business that you can see for right now?
No, but it would give it more authority, more, for example, to offer additional professional doctorates. We've just inaugurated one system-wide at Purdue in nursing, and that could be the first of others. It would also, the new status would also get them, would give them credit, which they don't receive in today's performance funding formula, for the high impact, which is roughly to say STEM degrees that they offer. And by our calculation, if they were given credit for those degrees, as West Lafayette is and IUPUI is, then it would increase their funding by an appreciable amount. So, you would tell a difference.
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. Remember, you can always send us questions at news@wbaa.org. You can tweet those questions at WBAA News on Twitter as well. So not long after we tape this show, you are off to Washington, D.C. to give a keynote address at a forum on global food security. This is something Purdue has dealt with for a long, long time. What do you plan to say to that conference about what Purdue is doing and about what challenges still need to be addressed more fully?
Well, I'll tell you what I plan for today. You know, I'm never quite sure till I walk in the room in most cases, but I know what they would like to hear about. And it is another very prestigious opportunity, so I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. I visited with our Dean of Agriculture. I visited with our World Food Prize winner, Dr. Ajeta, and so I've been asked, actually, to address the recent Council on Foreign Relations report of which I was the co-chair, about non-communicable diseases in developing countries. And there is an intersection of that with nutrition and malnutrition, and I will talk about that, but you can bet I will segue into, as I always look to do, some comments about Purdue's historic and current research leadership in meeting this global challenge of feeding 9 billion people.
What is Purdue's role going forward? I mean, how do you continue to be a leader as you address these various challenges?
One way, and you'll recall that one of our Purdue moves, two of them are heavy investments in basic research. And one of those two, not surprisingly, on the recommendation of faculty and our deans, one of those two is plant science, where our faculty have been pioneering and winning awards and saving lives for a long, long time. And we'll be investing tens of millions of dollars in trying to move to a position of equal or greater leadership in the future. So always a part of our mission, and now we're sort of doubling down, as they say, on that. Another possibility, when we hosted Howard Buffett here recently, he and I talked a lot, and in his presentation he talked about how great the land-grant system has been and was in lifting up this nation earlier in its development, and how planting land-grant schools in Africa and other less developed areas is part of that solution, too. And here, too, we hope Purdue can play a role.
So Howard Buffett, just to segue onto a different topic, is one of the people you've brought in for your presidential lecture series. And it's been interesting to see the people who have come in. And I've had the good fortune to talk to a couple of those people privately before their talks. How do you determine who's going to be part of this? Because these people come from all different walks of life.
Yeah. Well, there's no template we're using exactly. You can see certain patterns in there. First of all, I just thought that one thing that I could try to contribute to our university is to ramp up the intellectual traffic flow a little bit. And so we started this series. And by the way, we've also had some corporate leaders come, Jeff Immelt, Sam Allen, Mike Eskew from UPS and so forth. In what we call the presidential lecture series, you can see certain patterns. I look for things that we know are of interest in terms of the academic and intellectual nature of our place. So Paul Aramenko from Google would be a good example. Tom Vilsack, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, came to talk about, among other things, feeding a growing world. I guess you'd say Howard Buffett fit into pretty neatly into that. We've got a lot of people interested in global hunger on this campus. But I also sort of strive for variety. So Anant Agrawal, the brilliant computer scientist from MIT who started the edX, the big online education venture, I thought would be interesting both from a technological standpoint and because he and his company represent, let's say, a new challenge to traditional higher education. And then Mara Liasson, who's just an old friend from NPR, brought, I thought, a great balanced and objective perspective to comments about our public life. And a couple days after this taping, Harlan Coben, the number one mystery novelist in America, fascinating guy I got to know a few years ago, has agreed to come out. Here's somebody whose books debut at number one on the New York Times list. They all sell a million copies plus. And
I get the sense some part of this is just people you're going to have fun talking to.
Well, it's not about whether I'll have fun, but whether I think an audience might have fun.
Well, the thought is that if you are having fun, then they might too.
Well, I hope so. I hope that's the case. But we're just trying to bring some variety and interest, reach different audiences, different groups on and off campus who might enjoy a short evening with these people. So be happy to take suggestions, by the way, if listeners, if there are people you'd really like us to go after, you'd love to hear. Let me know, and we do plan to continue the series. They've been well attended, and I think they've enriched a little bit the intellectual climate on campus.
Is there a good way for people to submit those suggestions to you?
Yeah, just send them to the office. Just send them to the office of the president here, and we'll be glad to have any ideas.
This is WBAA and Indiana Public Broadcasting's Conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. You can send questions for us to news@WBAA.org, or you can tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. I wanted to get back for a few minutes to the conversation about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA, because, of course, your office, like so many other presidents' offices around the state, put out a letter talking a little bit about it. And you described yourself in the immediate aftermath of everything that went on as heartsick. I'm curious about that term. What did you mean by that?
Oh, I was just making a factual comment, not about the bill per se, but about its effect, temporary, and I think we're seeing it. Largely temporary, on the business reputation of the state. I was commenting specifically that there are a lot of people who had spent years working very substantively, not a matter of public relations, very substantively, at building up one of the best jobs and growth climates in the country by every measure, everybody's map of the best places to invest and have a chance to get your money back. Has Indiana on it, almost alone, by the way, outside the Sun Belt. And I'd heard from a lot of those people who were very downcast that a nationally renowned business climate was being it appeared damaged, at least in terms of its reputation. So that's what the comment was about. It was really just a factual report. My own view is, and I've expressed it, that any economic effects will be modest and not temporary. In fact, I think they'll be limited, if at all, to possibly some effect on the Indianapolis Convention business. Although there were a couple that said they might have second thoughts, and they're both coming to town anyway. So maybe even there the damage will be very, very limited. I hope so. But in terms of the broader picture, I thought a lot of loose talk was thrown around. The fundamentals will still prevail. If you're a state with a pro-growth profile and laws in place that improve the chances that if you come and hire Hoosiers, you'll have a success and get your money back, that's going to be what matters long term. And as long as we don't dismantle that, then this very unfortunate episode, I think, may have big effects in other areas, but not on our overall economy.
How did you think about it as in the prism of your previous job? Because, of course, you were one of the people who worked so hard to try to get this economic system in place. Did you feel that some of the work you had done was being imperiled in some way?
Oh, Stan, I think I just answered that question. No, not unless people start changing the fundamental laws and the improvements that we believe we made. But, you know, beyond that, we'll just see what happens. I hope that, as I just indicated, that there won't be a job lost anywhere over this, and Indiana will resume its position of economic strength and good reputation for it.
So one of the common themes, as I was doing a story on all of the different university responses to this, was that university presidents and their offices that I spoke to just about uniformly said, we have to be very careful if we step out and have a position on a social issue. How do you go about making those sorts of decisions for yourself and for your office on what you do comment on, what you don't comment on, and how you do that?
I don't have to make them. We have a 25-year-old policy of the Board of Trustees that says we won't take institutional positions on political issues. We will be, and we are doing doing things to enhance this. We will be a free speech campus of the first order. And we will foster debate, and we will welcome debate. We will protect those who feel strongly, as people felt so strongly about this issue, but we won't take institutional positions. That happens to be the point of view of most universities in the country, and of the 40-something, 47, I think, in Indiana, well over 40 stayed with that position. So, by the way, I have a second issue. It doesn't matter. It's superfluous because that's the one that controls the board policy. But, you know, I just don't think it's good practice for anybody to be second-guessing and commenting on folks who held their previous job. I don't think CEOs should do it. I don't think basketball coaches should do it. And I don't think people who held public office should do so. But, again, that's superfluous because I'm going to respect the policy that has been in place so long.
It seems somewhat unlikely, though, that if the person in your job was not the former governor of the state and was commenting on, or even a former lawmaker of any kind in the state, if it had been France Cordova or Martin Jiski who had gone out and made a comment, it seems unlikely that, for instance, the University Board of Trustees would have reprimanded them for doing so, doesn't it? I mean, it seems like, yes, this 25-year policy is in place, but at some point, universities are supposed to be institutions of leadership. And if there's an issue like this, plenty of presidents at universities around the state have felt, hey, we need to be leaders on this.
I completely disagree, but it doesn't matter. You know, that's a question to be put to the board. If someone actively disregarded a board policy, would you just let it slide or would you call them on it? guess an R board would call a president on something like that. But it'd be their choice whether to ignore their own rule or not.
This is WBAA and Indiana Public Broadcasting's Conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. Remember, you can find us on Twitter at WBAA News. You can also send your questions to news@wbaa.org if you are near your email. We talked on last month's show about the fact that Purdue's applications are up by quite a significant amount. What are you seeing? Have you had a chance in the intervening month to see anything more about those numbers and kind of drill them down anymore?
Of course, what matters now is how many decide to enroll. Because applications soared as they did, we have admitted more, and that was our goal. And more, year to date, measured every day, are now sending their deposits and saying they're coming. So we hope that holds up. Stays on track, we will have, as we wanted to have, a larger freshman class and be educating more students here at Purdue. This helps in a lot of ways. I mean, one, I think it's our job to send it out into Indiana and beyond as many well-educated Boilermakers as we can. Two, helps us diversify. If we want more members of underrepresented minority groups and so forth, a bigger class will help. And so that's another hope we have. But we're in that hold your breath period where students who the quality of students that are applying and we are admitting these days keeps going up. That means they have lots of choices. And so we know what history says about what percentage of a given group or cohort is likely to say yes, but we could be surprised. But all signs right now are positive, and I'm hoping for a strong, robust class, and we'll know soon.
So as you say, you've got historical data that you can drill down demographically. So you can say if you have an underrepresented minority and you want to try to diversify the class, it would seem like you could target admission standards or something like that, or target the number of people in that cohort you'd like to have at least apply to the school. Is that something you've done?
There's nothing we work out harder. I mean, you have to work at the whole continuum from we have programs that try to help minority students and first-generation students become more college-ready, at least in Indiana. We have intense recruiting programs aimed at those groups and schools where you find them. We work very hard after they have applied and we've admitted them to get them to come here. I make phone calls personally. I've got a list sitting on the desk over at Westwood. When I've got an extra, half hour some evening, it's what I do. So we work on this as hard as we can. But it's a problem. We've discussed it on this program before. Everywhere, every higher ed meeting I go to, everyone has this problem, including schools with great reputations, all the California schools, University of Michigan. When you look at the most common measure is underrepresented minorities compared to their percentage in the state. And we're about in the middle of our peer group on that. So because nobody's where they want to be.
I apologize for going back one second, but let me ask one other question that relates to RFRA. There has been some talk about universities worrying a little bit about the perception of the state, fair or unfair, as it relates to university recruitment. We had a story on earlier this week from our colleagues down in Bloomington who were talking to IU students coming in from California and other places and saying they'd heard about it. And it didn't appear to be making a huge dent on at least the people they talked to. But was this something you guys talked about in your office about how do we mitigate any possible problems here?
Well, we wondered about it. And I saw a letter or two. We just won't know for a while. My suspicion is that, like much of the other speculation, it probably will prove to have been exaggerated. Any effect will be less than people feared. But we'll worry about it till we know it's not true, and I hope it's not true.
It seems to me that at Purdue, where you've got about 50% in-state students and 50% out-of-state students, you know, it could potentially affect as much as, you know, half of your recruiting.
Well, people loosely say these things. You know, students choose universities for a whole lot of reasons, and I'm not saying this would never enter in. All I can say is I don't think we've seen the evidence so far. Let's hope of any damage. Let's hope that we don't. Remember that Purdue's policy is so clear and so explicit and far-reaching, and the whole furor here, as you pointed out, gave us the opportunity to reiterate it. And so any student who's looking at Purdue understands that we're open and welcoming to all, and you'd hope that would be what they wanted to know.
We've got just a few minutes left. I wanted to talk about this transdisciplinary degree that trustees have approved for the new Purdue Polytechnic Institute, because you have said it sort of moves away from credit hours and the focus on that to focusing on competency. Do you know what you need to do to be able to get into the workforce? Does that mean that you could have, for instance, a really, really talented freshman or sophomore who passes their requirements and goes out into the work world?
Well, I don't know about 1 year or two, but it certainly could mean that the most talented and diligent students could move through more quickly. They could move at the rate at which they can demonstrate they have mastered a given topic and are ready for the next one. That's why the whole higher ed world is interested and excited about this. It will bring significant changes. You have to make adjustments to the way we've always done things. But that's one reason why I believe what our College of Technology is attempting here may be the single most noteworthy and innovative of all our current strategic moves. If it is successful, all the signs are positive right now. There's big student interest, and they haven't really even been able to fully promote the polytechnic concept. Those students who went through the first-year pilot, very positive feedback from that. So we're very hopeful. But, yeah, it leaves a lot of problems to work out.
In our last couple of seconds, does it affect your bottom line if more people are getting out more quickly than they have in the past?
If it does, it does. We're here to help students and help the state and the nation. We'll deal with issues if being a more affordable place to go to school, if helping students move through on a 3-year track as our College of Liberal Arts is, in a competency base as the Polytechnic Institute, if that means has revenue implications, it's our job not to impede that progress, but to celebrate that progress and to find ways to accommodate to it administratively and institutionally.
Just real quick, this goes along with the giant grant the Lilly Foundation gave to help do things like establish the Polytechnic Institute. In 10 seconds, does it enable you potentially to get more grants to offset whatever financial things?
I can say is Lilly's hardly the only place. In fact, the Senate budget you asked me about, they also fastened on the Polytechnic Institute and have suggested a grant of their own to help us get it going. It has attracted a lot of positive attention from private companies, the public sector, the philanthropic sector, and that's why we're so excited.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll talk about that in future shows. And remember that you can find archived versions of this show at WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Have a good rest of your day.